Hello and welcome to my podcast. I am your host, Volker Balüder. I have been recording this podcast to give you a listening experience for your personal development. Having had mentors and coaches, trusted advisors and friends to bounce ideas off, I wanted to pay my learning forward. Enjoy the conversations I have with my mentors and hopefully you learn something on the way and discover something new for yourself. For more information and latest info what I'm up to, you can visit me on www.balüder.com or just look me up on LinkedIn. You can reach out to me on Twitter, which is @Balüder, or email me, Volker@Balüder.com. Now, without further ado, let's jump into this week's episode. Enjoy the experience. So this week's podcast is with Lizzie Hotcroft. She's a winner of the Northeast Entrepreneur for 2 years in a row. And Lizzie embraces what is to be a founder and an inspiration at the same time. She is very honest about her struggles with mental health and how entrepreneurship aided in her recovery. It's the story, if I say, a breath of fresh air with being, if I say, competitive at times, but also a draining business environment. And she really, if I say, used that as a catalyst to overcome her struggles. So a very interesting story we can look forward to. We're recording this. You might have noticed, obviously, my themes at the moment around mental health as a podcast. During the lockdown still, we're just kind of coming out. So we're doing Mental Health Awareness Week as well. So very timely to speak to Lizzie. Throughout building her two businesses, which if I say one of them she sold, Lizzie has been able to provide a strong insight into the importance of laying a stable personal foundation in order to build a successful business. Most recently, her business Minder, which has won an FSB Startup of the Year award, has received over 300 grand in government funding. So she offers both inspirational key speaking as well as workshops to empower others to create a growth mindset for taking more risk, becoming more resilient, and achieving balance. Other topics, if I say, include raising investment and how to create tech for good. I mean, that's her new project, Minder, and that's what it's all about. But first of all, Lizzie, welcome to my podcast.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm really pleased to be a part of this. So obviously my name is Lizzie. I am the co-founder of a company called Minder. The other founder that I work with is a lady called Emma Riley. And we started this back in September 2018. At the time, I was just in the process of selling my first business, the Sweet Beet, which was in a completely different space. That was working with food as I grew up studying as a chef, and then did a complete turnaround into mental health with Minder and Emma. And I think part of what spurred me into that journey was just kind of at first sort of moving into the entrepreneurial space that I had never been a part of before. And as somebody who has struggled with mental health issues since about the age of 14, it was really interesting to see how those were exacerbated, yet also completely calmed down through founding my own business and building that business. I always say that my business kind of saved my life. And I think a big part of that is because it helped me to go through this growth process. I had room to make mistakes, but I also had room to make amazing decisions that worked out really well. And it really helped to build my confidence in regards to just being more okay with who I was and what my strengths and weaknesses were. At the same time, building a business, regardless of whether you have mental health issues, can be a really difficult thing. And when you're looking for especially things like investment or you're looking to partner with other companies, one of the things that might sit in the back of your mind is, you know, how honest am I about my past and my personal life and who I am and what's got me to where I am today? And I think for me, I just didn't want to compromise on that. So I became, as time went forward, more and more vocal about my own journey in mental health, being in a psychiatric hospital, going to rehab, and really hoping to drive this kind of inspiring yet weirdly relatable message of, you know, we're all just kind of bumbling about doing the best that we can with what we have. and how important it is to enjoy that process, because the outcome may never be what you ever expected. And of course, we never tend to dwell on outcomes for too long before we move on to the next challenge or goal that we want to accomplish.
Yeah.
So when Emma approached me to get involved in Minder and saying that she wanted to do something within the mental health space, it was, you know, didn't even have to think about it. I was already committed.
Okay. I mean, I'm trying to think where we best start. Do you want to start with your story about, if I say that, I don't know if you want to speak about psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
Say maybe your mental health story, because the regular listener would have listened to Sean Betts, who I interviewed recently, who had a burnout at work. He's from the media industry. He's still in the media industry. And if I say in our generation, it was always a stigma to talk about it, right? About mental health, and that has changed so much, which is so great. So if I say, the more we can share the word, and also what I would be curious about, what if I say in line with what you just said, is I always thought, you know, you don't want to talk about it in case you have, you know, especially if you have an interview or you approach an employer, and you were mentioning in terms of going for funding, right? I mean, how do investors react when you say, oh, actually I have mental health problems?
So we've come across that. I mean, I think when you are so willing to be raw with your struggles and kind of where you've been, especially if that place included something like addiction, people are uncomfortable, especially a lot of the older generation. They're uncomfortable to be faced with that kind of honesty, and they don't know what to do with that kind of information. And I think it embarrasses them for you, if you get what I mean.
Yep.
And I remember, and I'll go into my mental health story from the beginning here soon, but I remember Emma and I drove up to the borders of Scotland, and we had a pitch there to an angel syndicate. Now, don't get me wrong, they were all lovely, lovely people, but they were kind of the older white man generation.
Yeah.
And they actually told us that maybe we shouldn't be so honest and share as much about our own mental health background, because it would make other people feel that we're not reliable or able to pull this business off. And it's wasn't the first time that we heard it, and it certainly hasn't been the last, and I'm sure we'll continue to hear it.
Yeah.
But I also feel like it's what connects us to our followers and to the rest of the world that's just discovering us. And I think that we owe it not just to our business and to ourselves, but to those who want to be involved in the business and want to use what we are building, to be as authentic about this as possible. And people relate to that. They want to buy into that. We no longer want to see the images and the sort of idea of these people that are so perfect and beyond what we could ever be that we just feel crap about ourselves.
Yeah.
We want to see real people that have been through real struggle that we can identify with and find hope and inspiration from. So that's my two cents on that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And you know what Sean actually said when I said, because obviously he recruits people as well, he's quite senior, and he says, I'd rather have someone telling me he or she has had problems with, say, depression or anxiety or anything else, because that person probably knows her or himself a lot better than a person that has never had those struggles. And I thought that was fascinating to hear. But to your point, and, you know, without stereotyping, the older white generation, men probably in particular, right? I think have a problem coping with that. And I always classify myself as an in-between generation. So I was born 1977, a generation which was obviously heavily influenced by people that could not talk about their feelings at all, especially in particular in Germany, and a generation that was so open-minded, right? And talks about all these things. So it's interesting what you say there. So how did you get funding then? Obviously not from those guys.
No, not from those guys. We actually decided to go down the grant route, which is something that's not always explored enough, I don't think, especially by young startup businesses. I think part of the reason for that is that the grant process is long, and just the application itself, you know, if you're going to do it right, can take a good amount of time. This is not something that you can just sit down and bash out in one sitting. There's a lot of effort that needs to go into it, and potentially collaboration. And of course, there's also this chance that you might not get anything at the end of it. So I think that puts a lot of people off. And to be fair, I think also depending on your business industry, it can be difficult. With Minder, we were able to obviously write a good application, but I think when we are describing the impact that we can have locally, regionally, nationally, and potentially worldwide, it's a lot easier to do that with something that is looking out to empower people when it comes to their mental health and well-being. I mean, it's a lot easier to follow that storyline and to understand where the deliverables are going to come to fruition than it is maybe in a different industry of business. But I mean, as I said, it takes a long time. We entered our submission for this grant in October. We found out that we got it in January. We weren't able to start the project until April. So that's a good 6 months. But obviously the great thing about getting a grant is that we're not giving away equity. We've been able to get, you know, a big substantial amount of cash that we probably wouldn't have been able to raise at such an early stage in our business. And now when we are ready to raise, we'll be giving away a lot less equity because we will be so much further down the line. And I think going down that has really been helpful. We also get to really just focus on what we need to be building and what we need to be doing, because we don't have that worry of needing to chase revenue all the time in order to survive while we continue to prototype our platform.
Before we talk about the platform and Minder, do you want to quickly touch on your own personal story?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up, I was born in Scotland, but I grew up in Texas, where my mom and her family are. And I was very lucky. My dad's British. He's still lived over here. So throughout the summers and every other winter, both myself and my older sister would travel from Texas over to the northeast of England and spend our summers and every other Christmas there. But I never really had any big issues until I turned about 14. Now, looking back with a little bit of hindsight, I can now kind of see where maybe some underlying issues were there. I think even from a really, really young age, I was very body conscious, and I struggled with my self-image. But it wasn't until I was 14 that I kind of really started to struggle with my mental health and started to use the services that were available. I wish I could say that there was like one thing that caused it all, but I do honestly believe that it's partly just a predisposition thing. Depression does run in my family, and addiction also runs in my family. So at 14, I had my first suicide attempt. I ended up in a psychiatric hospital, which was so unbelievably like a girl interrupted. It was really, really weird. In the terms of, you know, I got transferred to the mental health unit at about 11 o'clock at night. And of course, arriving at any kind of psychiatric hospital can be daunting in its own sense, but arriving at nearly midnight and all the lights are off and everything's dimly lit and quiet is even more scary. I kind of get sort of scurried down the hall after they check through all my stuff and take all my shoelaces and all that kind of stuff. And then they put me into this room and, you know, basically say, right, we'll try and get some sleep. We'll talk to you in the morning. And as I enter the room, I realize that I'm not alone. There's another girl there. And, you know, she turned out to be a lovely, lovely girl, but at that point in time, not knowing her and coming into this crazy new environment, I noticed that she's nearly pulled out all her hair. And so I'm feeling really anxious and just getting tucked in. I look up at the ceiling and somebody's managed to get up there and write with a red marker, "I am watching you." So needless to say, I didn't get much sleep last night, that night. And I kind of felt like after that, you know, I'll probably be fine. We started messing around with antidepressants. It took a while to find, you know, kind of what worked for me. But I think what probably then exacerbated after that was the next year I tore my ACL. Now, I was an avid soccer player. I played on the varsity team. I also did cross country and track. And tearing my ACL meant that all of that was taken away from me in just a second. And I think it was just losing that little bit of stability that kind of pushed me towards this sort of path of self-destruction. I had no reason not to smoke and drink anymore because I wasn't doing sports. My friends started to change, and I started to turn inward on myself a lot. I think for a lot of us, and I don't just mean this in the teenage years that we grow up in, I'm sure that exacerbates the problem, but just understanding who you are is an incredibly difficult and sometimes painful process, and it especially was for me. And it definitely didn't end there. I got sent to an outpatient treatment center for eating disorder because I started to struggle with anorexia and bulimia. That got kind of exacerbated by me then getting into drugs and cocaine and stuff like that. And then finally, at the age of 17, I got sent to rehab. So I got sent to rehab up in Utah, and I was there for about 5 months. And when I got out, I moved over to the UK. My mom basically said, you know, we don't really want you back home. Obviously, it wasn't like a personal thing. It's just she didn't want me hanging out with the same people, going back into the same environment.
Yeah.
So I moved over to the UK and I lived here for about a year. I did all right. I was still struggling with depression and some eating, but I, you know, was stabling out a little. But went back to Texas after a year and completely lost the plot again. I mean, there were times where I was spending so many days off my face on drugs and not eating anything that I would just faint to the floor and wake up there. So I wasn't healthy, and I continued to kind of go back and forth and struggle and, you know, start setting this expectation of, well, anything good in my life, I'll mess it up. I'll just push it away. I'll figure out how to destroy it. And it wasn't until I turned 24 that I really started to make a big corner and a big turnaround. And a big part of that was that I went over to Texas to visit for 2 weeks. And in that 2 week period, I managed to get myself addicted to heroin and engaged to a drug dealer.
Wow.
Yeah.
You've done it all, haven't you?
Oh man, I don't know how I fit so much stuff in. I guess it was not sleeping ever. And once that 2 week visit was over and I finally got back on the plane, well, obviously 10-hour flight or so, I'm immediately going through withdrawals. It was one of the worst flights I've ever been on and nearly made them land the plane in Canada and drop me off because I was having like asthma attacks and panic attacks and stuff on the plane.
Yeah,
but made it to the UK, but it was kind of like I'd crossed the line at that point. Before that, you know, and thank goodness to my parents and the resources that they had, I had always been able to mess up and then sort of hold my hands up in the air. And the thing about once you get into this sort of cycle of treatment centers is that they become kind of like your reset button. So I could mess up as much as I wanted to or happened to, and I could always just kind of go into some sort of treatment center afterwards and give all my problems to somebody else and have somebody tell me what to do, and I wouldn't have to worry about anything. And I didn't really have that this time. I had crossed the line. I was, you know, my mom's brother had passed away when I was only maybe 2 years old or so, and because he had overdosed on heroin. So for me to then go to my mom and to be like, hey, I'm really sorry, but I got myself on heroin and, you know, I'm struggling and stuff, was just not an option. But I knew that I was starting to crumble. Like, I remember turning to one of my good friends one night with just tears in my eyes and just saying, listen, I'm gonna die. Like, I don't know whether it's going to be today or tomorrow or next month or next year, but my body is starting to shut down. I can feel it. I can feel it in my heart. And I just don't think that I will continue to survive if I keep, you know, going through these cycles over and over again. It cannot take it anymore. And at that point, I had to get better all on my own. So I spent, you know, a few months just getting up in the morning, teaching myself how to eat again, teaching myself how to just do little things like taking care of the chores and all these other, you know, really minute things, but were starting to build up into a series of little small wins for me. And it just so happened that during that same time period is when I started my first business. And that's, I think, where the rest of the healing process really started to take place. And I started to come into my own. I mean, it was the first time that I could actually see and understand the value that I had for myself, but also the value that I had to offer and share with the world. And that was major. That was major for me and a real, real turning point.
So when, or how long is that ago?
So that was probably about 6 years ago.
Oh.
Yeah. So I think I've come a long way in a short space of time. I mean, I'm sure part of the process is maturity. I don't think anyone ever really has able to emphasize enough what just time can do in terms of your outlook and what hindsight can bring you in terms of wisdom.
Yeah.
But again, I just don't think I can credit enough what building a business did for me. Being able to kind of go out on my own and challenge myself and test myself and really start to understand what I can do. And the talent and the strengths that I have was massive. I wasn't able to explore that in any other situation I had been in to that point.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, there's a lot in there, right? So you obviously, I think it's fantastic that you got over all that. I mean, that must have been horrendous few years, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had numerous hospital visits for suicide attempts or for, you know, self-harm, that kind of stuff. I mean, there have been times where, you know, I just couldn't imagine doing anything else but like ripping off all my skin and, you know, just to get some sort of emotion out. And it is painful. But I think that it has made me into a really interesting person with a lot of empathy and dimension to my personality. And I definitely wouldn't change it. I hope that now, if anything, I can just maybe articulate some of the things that I've learned to other people and maybe save them some of the heartache.
If I say that's a nice segue to talk about Minder. Is that what Minder is all about? Is that about articulating the things you've learned or what?
Yeah, absolutely. So both Emma and I have kind of been well versed in the support systems around mental health, both here in the UK, but also obviously I've got a little bit of experience with what it's like in the US as well.
Yeah.
What we've both been quite disappointed with is the way that a lot of the approaches to mental health, mindfulness, wellness can be a bit fluffy and sometimes can seem a bit condescending, I think.
Yeah.
And especially if you have sort of, you know, a sharp mind and you know, you've been through a lot of different experiences, it can be really disheartening to just be told, you know, well, maybe you should try yoga or go for a walk or, you know, try affirmations, especially if you're in the midst of some sort of a crisis. And the other thing that we kind of had cottoned on to is that we're much more likely to listen and try things that other people from similar situations have done. Even if it just helps to kind of break down that stigma and help you to not feel as alone. And then the third thing was, it's all great telling somebody to try and make some goals for themselves or try and write down what makes them happy or, you know, have a routine. But a lot of us need a lot more structure than that, especially if we're going through some sort of mental health issue. You know, our cognitive load completely decreases and we cannot take in as much information and we're not able to process as quickly. So sometimes asking somebody that's struggling with anxiety or depression to look at how they can sort of plan their day and their life around getting better can be just completely overwhelming. And unless you have that one-on-one access to a psychologist or a counselor, then you don't have anyone really there to support you to help to create that structure. So we wanted to create a system that would help people to get really good suggestions based around things that people have done previously, that have been through something similar that they have, that they can then kind of pull and pick and choose and sort of put into a bit of an action plan so that they actually have kind of a road and a path forward. But also looking at real practical things they can do, they can take action on, where they actually feel as though they're making some progress. And I think that was kind of where we started in regards to what we wanted to make. We spent about a year just doing a ton of research, talking with anybody and everybody who would give us the time. Both in business from an HR perspective, but also from a patient perspective and also sort of a professional perspective, like a psychologist or a doctor. You know, what was the mental health journey? Where were things going wrong? And, you know, what were people taking away from it? And then what were they just absolutely hating? And we started to formulate this kind of plan and pinpoint. I mean, don't get me wrong. At one point, I just thought, man, this thing's so big and there's so many issues. We're never going to be able to make an impact. But we started to figure out that what we needed was something that could deliver personalized actions and interventions, but based bespokely on the user and reflecting their learning style, if they had a physical disability or some sort of learning disability, so that all of that can be taken into account, including previous, you know, support if they were given it and what it is they wanted to work on. So we could then make sure that they were only getting the very best, most relevant information that they could then move into action plans as they saw fit.
Okay. And that's what the app does, I assume.
Yeah. I mean, what kind of differentiates Minder, I think, is number one, this kind of idea that there's a lot of wisdom to be had from peer experiences and we need to harness that. But it's also the artificial intelligence element that we use to provide users with the advice and support tailored to their needs. So essentially, the more that users work with and respond to Minder, the better we are able to sort of showcase bespoke plans and ideas and suggestions for them. At the same time, what I think is really interesting is that at the minute, treatments, as we know, are most effective when they're delivered to the right people at the right time and obviously in the right way. But currently, we don't really know what mental health treatments will work for whom. And this, of course, wastes a lot of valuable time, money, and devastatingly lives. So although there's not widely known so much a market for anonymized mental health data, really the reports and the research show that demand, both socially and commercially, is there. And I think some of the insights that we may be able to gain is going to be really, really interesting. And what we want to do with those is essentially look at how we might aggregate and anonymize all the data to help advise on policy and intervention change when it comes to the government and also the NHS here in the UK.
Yeah. Who would be your target audience? Would it be individuals or, as you just said, so NHS, government, would they...
We've kind of got a three-pronged approach. Yeah. Initially, we've been working with Home Group, which is one of the UK's largest residential housing associations. They have a lot of houses for those that need a bit more support, whether they've just left a hospital, a psychiatric hospital, or whether they just need a bit more to get through life. And so we're able to work with them to kind of understand what it is they need, both from a client point of view, but also from an employee point of view. Because even though, you know, we are very focused on the individual, at the end of the day, Minder's a business. And for us to gain revenue quickly, it's going to be working with organizations and their employees. Yeah. And looking at how we can help to put something in place preventatively before people go into crisis. However, what excites me more than anything is the individual offer, the fact that, you know, anybody can go on and access the system and use it. And the way that we see that initially working is that we can work with the NHS to put MINDR on the map as something that can be socially prescribed, so that when somebody goes to their GP and asks for support and says that they need help, if they are put on a wait list, they can at least get some support in the meantime, start, you know, looking into what's going wrong and tracking their mood and moving forward with their life. Or if the GP or the doctor deems them too well to access the mental health services here in the UK, then again, they're still getting support. They're getting something that can help to empower them to find some sort of resolution and the emotional tools that they may need to get through a difficult period.
I think it's fantastic that you're doing that. I mean, you know, still being a business, but I think it will add so much value to the whole, let's say, process and individual's life, as you say, right? That's the exciting bit that you can have that access. So when are you going live? What's the plan?
So we're in closed testing at the minute, and we'll probably remain in closed testing for a while longer. We were hoping to launch kind of officially in October, but part of that launch was going to be a big get together and kind of event and showcase, which we are not sure we're going to be able to do because of lockdown. So we're thinking probably January next year is when we'll launch it, so that anybody can kind of access it and get that kind of support. But I'll keep you posted if anything goes faster than we had hoped.
Yes, please do. I mean, as we just talked about, right? So I'm teaching mindfulness as well, which I'm doing my little bit in terms of mindfulness to help people to deal with stress and anxiety, and giving them the tools. You know, haven't developed an app. I think there are probably plenty of meditation mindfulness apps out there. So I'm not entering that market.
Apologies to interrupt your listening experience. I hope you're enjoying it so far. I just wanted to make you aware that my online course for coaching, where you can discover your values, mission and purpose in life, is now live on bebetter.baluda.com. Any sign up or recommendation for others to sign up is greatly appreciated. Now back to our episode.
What you just touched upon of the COVID-19 lockdown, I want to spend a few minutes, if I say, discussing that with you, and if I say, get your expert opinion on that as well.
Yeah, it's been an interesting one. Obviously, you know, I feel like I do need to acknowledge that I am lucky. I have a, you know, very comfortable flat that I live in, and I have access to an outside yard. And you know, I'm in isolation with my partner, and we get along very well. So I am very aware that I have been privileged to have had the kind of experience within lockdown that I have. I know that there are a lot of people that are still stuck in potentially quite manipulative or abusive environments. And even if that isn't the case, there's a lot of people stuck in really, really small spaces with potentially no real access to outside space. But at least for myself during this period, and from some people that I've spoken to, one of the interesting things that has happened during this period is all of a sudden having the headspace to start figuring things out and being able to really start to go through this kind of releasing of guilt that you're not doing enough. And learning how to kind of get used to having so much beyond our control during this period.
Yeah.
I've personally started to notice that I've grown more in confidence, especially within my work. And I think part of that is just that I'm free from the scrutiny that I probably believe that I'm under when I'm out in the real world. And I'm starting to really get that kind of creativity flourishing again, and not trying to second guess other people's feelings or judgments of me. And that has really helped me to become a lot lighter and be a little bit more confident in my resolution and my ideas. I really do think that there's a lot of freedom to be found in the breakdown of structure in regards to the lockdown. And what I have been trying to do during this time is to write little pieces that also help to showcase that we don't all need to have some sort of coming of age paradigm shift during this time either. I think some of us have probably logged onto social media at times and saw that, you know, okay, well, this guy's learned a new language, that person's redone their kitchen, and, you know, this person's planted an amazing vegetable patch or whatever it may be. And some of us then go, well, I haven't been able to do anything that constructive during lockdown. And that's okay. Some of us do just need to spend the time losing ourselves in Netflix or playing video games. And I don't want anybody to, you know, use this time to continue to berate themselves for things that are so out of their control.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of, if I say the general experience, it's interesting what you just said there, because I think you're absolutely right. You have more headspace. And I think what I find for myself, and you just said it as well, right? You're learning about your boundaries, right? So I'm someone, I like to work, right? So I'm working, if I say, all day. And then once of a sudden you have your family 24/7, or you have, you know, you realize you're working too much. And finding this work-life balance, I think, has been difficult for a lot of people, but it's a good learning experience.
It's a great learning experience. I mean, for me, it was almost kind of backwards, because I was really, really good at, when I come home, I'm home. I'm really quite strict with not really doing any work when I'm at home, as you know, as long as I don't have like a project coming up that has to be due and I haven't finished it yet or whatever. So actually for the first couple of weeks, it was hard to turn my brain on to think that I had to work at home. But that has changed. I'm getting into a good routine now, but still, I mean, you know, I try to make sure that I'm done by 5 or so, if not slightly earlier. and I don't put a lot of stress on myself to, you know, whiz through and spend this time just getting as much done as I possibly can. I think that, you know, part of what's amazing about this time is that you do have the time to reflect and to just kind of be and not worry about filling every moment with, you know, something crazy exciting. It's okay just to sit there and enjoy the sun.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess the weather has helped, of course, at least in the UK, for most part of the lockdown. I mean, the other challenge, I say, and again, asking your expert opinion, I mean, a lot of people obviously, and you already said, right, in terms of, you know, you're in a comfortable flat, you have outside space, and, you know, I'm very lucky, I live, you know, in the South Downs, we have green space, we have a garden, but a lot of people aren't that lucky. A lot of people have been furloughed, lost their jobs, you know, might not have any savings. So they have, you know, if I say financial struggles, they might have, you know, you said abusive struggles. I mean, there's a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, of course, going on. What do you think is the impact on mental health in particular? The other day I called it the COVID-19 generation, or generation COVID. What do you think the impact is, if I say, on us, or on people that have these struggles?
I think it's pretty massive. I mean, if you think about it, at least for myself, I had basically from the years of 14 to 24 to work through my crap, right?
Yeah.
Plus 6 years of reflecting on it and, you know, coming to terms. So I kind of dealt with most of my issues before I got stuck by myself in my own brain.
Yeah.
A lot of people won't have done that. A lot of people, this will be the first time that they are finding themselves in a room with their thoughts and nothing else to take them away from it. And that can be massive and just really disrupting and hard to learn how to do. I'll throw my hands up. It was probably one of the most difficult transition and growing periods that I went through, was just learning how to be okay with me and sit with myself.
Yep.
And so I can imagine that all of these issues and different things from the past and even maybe present that people haven't dealt with are now looking at the future ahead and feeling like they have no other option but to do that. But now they're doing it completely by themselves. And they're doing it, you know, in a way where, you know, it's not monitored. They're not just going to a counselor and unloading and then getting built back up before they enter back into the world and can then, you know, think about something else and go back to work or back home to their family. It's something that's always present. And I think that not just the mental health aspect of it, but the kind of burnout of it all, just having to carry that much stress for such a long period of time is going to have a real long-term effect. And not just here in the UK, but in all countries around the world. And it's something that I think is going to have to be acknowledged in a big way.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I guess that's where... And the question is, who has the responsibility? Is it with the government? Is it with the individual? Is it with the companies they're working for, they're employed with?
So I would say that there's kind of two sides to answering that. I think that unless the government and the health system is set up well enough for everybody that needs support to get the support that they need, then you cannot blame the individual. I think that at the minute, at least here in the UK, we do not have a funded and resourced enough system to be able to provide the support that people need when they need it. And they especially do not spend a lot of time or money or resources on preventative care, which is really where we need to be. I do think that there is a certain onus to the individual. I mean, it's like anything else. If you can't, you know, find the motivation or the want or the need to change and to find yourself in a better place, then it won't happen. And that's a hard one to swallow, I think, for a lot of people. We like to blame everybody but ourselves. And we like to find reasons why we can't change or can't find happiness, because it's easier to do that than it is to actually change our thinking and adapt. But again, as I said, if you don't have the resources there for people to get the extra support, then, you know, it's really hard to look at the individual and say, well, you know, it's your fault. I do think that employers do have a certain responsibility. But I wouldn't necessarily look to blame them. I think there are certain steps that can be made, certain changes, especially in regards to things like flexible time and people being able to work from home, potentially looking at 4-day working weeks and being able to support them more around wellness and mindfulness and well-being. But at the end of the day, you know, the company is still a company. And I think we can only kind of point the finger so far in their direction.
Yeah, I think it's just so personally, I find it so frustrating to see that some companies, if I say don't want to or can't offer the support, and other companies, obviously, if I say bigger ones, if I say have both resources and, you know, if I say the willingness to do so and really support the employees.
Well, I think the companies that say that they don't want to, I think a lot of that is, I don't think it's malicious. I think it's simply because they really don't understand it. Emma and I have sat down with people that we've looked on board or at least get some sort of research from. And we have sat with HR managers that have turned to us in a large organization and said, no one has mental health problems here. Everyone's fine. And you just think like that is totally not true. But a lot of people are still stuck in this mentality of if they're not, you know, throwing up their food, cutting their wrists, or, you know, wanting to jump off a bridge, then they're fine. And of course, a lot of employees aren't going to share that kind of information with the HR manager either. So I think part of it is just this misunderstanding of mental health and what support can do for people. And then I think the other thing is that some businesses just get this idea that if you just follow the motions, then you can still reap the rewards. Well, that's just not true. You can't you can't approach this as a tick box exercise. The change has to be cultural, and it has to be something that's felt throughout the organization, all the way from the very, you know, tiniest employee that just started, all the way up to, you know, the CEO and the people that are driving the business forward.
And I hope that that awareness will increase now within companies. And as you just said, I mean, it's sad to, you know, say hear that, but I hear it regularly. And I mean, there's nothing, you know, if I say more fulfilling for myself at the moment. So I'm run the time of recording. I just finished a mindfulness course with a group in the legal sector, and I'm starting another one next week. To hear the benefits they have gained from a 6-week course, and it was all delivered via Zoom, you know, and just being able to cope with the whole situation they're in so much better, and, you know, giving them, if I say tools, you know, not fluffy things, but proper tools to combat exactly that. So
absolutely, and that's amazing. And I also just think, in regards to just learning and continuing to, you know, challenge yourself and bring in new information and insight is in itself a massive healing process, and a great way to help keep your spirits high, you know, just continuing to feel as though you are flexing and becoming a better person.
Exactly. Lizzie, before we come to an end, what would be your personal advice be, if I say in terms of mental health, so for someone who might be suffering and hasn't spoken out, or, you know, maybe even companies, or, you know, if I say, I could ask you for advice for the government, but let's maybe leave that for another time. What would you, your one piece of advice for someone around mental health be?
So I would definitely say that, you know, there's a lot of reassurance to be discovered through this chaotic time that we find ourselves in. I know for me personally, and a lot of people, our expectations are changing from one hour to the next. Our outlook is switching from disheartened to optimistic, from unbothered to energized and back again. But we will realize that this is the process, the journey, and not the outcome.
Yeah.
The other thing I think is important is, while the world may have come to a standstill, nature definitely hasn't. You know, birds are now the main backing track to my day most of the time. And taking that time to absorb the natural world in whatever form it presents itself to you will help to remind you to be present and appreciate this calm, instead of desperately clutching to stability in our future, which is completely out of our control right now. So just try and make sure that you're putting time and goodwill towards what you want to accomplish and who you want to be. And really just, you know, take that time to continue to reflect. And even as we start to ease out of this lockdown, I think making sure that we are taking note of what we have, what has changed that we have appreciated, and what has changed that we haven't, will help us to then rebuild our lives in a way that is more adapted to what we need.
Brilliant. I think that's, but there's nothing to add from my end. This is fantastic. I was literally just meditating this morning with the birds singing, and went for an early morning walk with my 11-year-old. And that was, you know, as you say, there's nothing more beautiful about it, right? To enjoy those moments.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't say it better myself.
Yeah. So who wants to find out more about you? Where would they go? Is it Mindr.com or?
So if you're interested in finding out more about Mindr, it also has a little bit of a blurb about me, which is Mindr, MYNDR.co.UK.
Co.UK, okay.
I also have my own personal blog, which is weirdlyrelatable.com.
Okay, so I'll put that all in the show notes. And if people want to get in touch, they find your social media links in there?
Yep. So they can either email me at Lizzie, L-I-Z-Z-Y, at mindr.co.uk, or you can find me both on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram under Weirdly Relatable.
Perfect. And thank you so much for your time today, Lizzie.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you again for listening to this week's podcast episode. Just a few things before you go. If you like this podcast, please leave me a 5-star rating on the outlet you're listening to. It's easily done and would mean a lot to me. For any feedback, please reach out to me on volker@baluda.com or email me volker@baluda.com. Until next time, this is your host, Volker Baluda.